Good evening to each and every one of you. Thank you for being here tonight. The Lord has blessed us so well on this day. We're thankful that you are here with us again this evening as we open up God's Word again together. We are going to be in the Revelation chapter 1, beginning verse 17. This evening is where we're going to begin. Revelation chapter 1, beginning verse 17, and reading through verse 20. I'm going to read John's response to what he sees of Jesus in this vision where Jesus is described in such magnificent terms, beginning in verse 12 and going through verse 16. This is how John reacted, though, here in Revelation 1 and verse 17. John says, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. He put his hand on me and said, 'Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead, but look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Therefore, write what you have seen, what is, and what will take place after this. The mystery of the seven stars you saw in my right hand, and of the seven golden lampstands is this: the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches.'" Unfortunately, I think too often, too many people, whenever they read Revelation, they have the same reaction to Revelation that John has here. They fall down on the ground like dead people. They're scared. They're intimidated. They don't understand what they're reading because of the vivid imagery and the dramatic storyline. However, fear of the great words written in this book will only hinder us from being blessed by those same great words. If we are fearful, intimidated by this book, we're not going to gain from it what God intended for us to gain from it. And if ever there was a portion of the book of Revelation that we ought to love to read and that we ought to gain much from, it is the writings in this book that are given to the seven churches that are found within Asia Minor. Last Sunday, we started a series going through the seven churches that are found here within Revelation chapter 2 and 3. And we look first of all at the church in Ephesus that was commended for their strong stance upon true doctrine and true faith. And yet they were quickly rebuked for not loving the Lord as they once had. And we read of a warning to this church that they needed to return to their first love before it was too late. I hope we have taken those words to heart and recognize that within our own lives there is the danger of ourselves falling short of the love that we once had for God. We need to be a people who love Him with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our mind, and with all of our strength. He is worthy to be loved because He first loved us. And He desires to reward us for that love and for that faithfulness, for that love for truth, by giving us eternal access to the tree of life. That's what we read in the first message to the church in Ephesus. The next church that we're going to address this evening is the church in Smyrna, which is entitled the Persecuted Church. Out of the seven churches sent, or out of the seven messages sent to the churches in Asia Minor, only two of them do not contain any words of criticism or rebuke. The church of Smyrna is one such church, and the church of Philadelphia is the second. For tonight, though, we want to focus here on this church that was persecuted. And because of its persecution, and let me make a point, that it is not the only church that is found within these couple of chapters that was facing persecution. But it is one of only two, as I mentioned, that did not have any other issues to go along with that, issues on their own part. But be that as it may, what we see here within this text is great encouragement from Jesus. Encouragement within just a few short verses that would help them as they face the persecution that was present within their lives in the city of Smyrna. And for us, as we read this text, it should be able to fill us as well with encouragement and strength and confidence, knowing that whatever persecution we might face, we can overcome with the Lord's help as well. Before we get into the text of Revelation 2 and verses 8 through 11, let's look quickly at some historical background for Smyrna because it is pertinent to what is written here in the text of Revelation 2, 8 through 11. To begin with, I want us to recognize that Smyrna was located, like Ephesus, on the western shore of Asia Minor on the Aegean Sea, and it was due north of Ephesus, only about 30 to 35 miles from Ephesus. This is important because, as we understand from the way things operated during that time, the roads were not like they are today. There are many different roads you could take. Normally people would take the same road over and over again. If you were traveling from the north to the south to get to Ephesus, you were probably going to go through Smyrna. Therefore, a lot of the traffic that Ephesus would get, Smyrna would get as well. It was a city that tried its very best to compete with Ephesus and to compete with the official capital of Pergamum as the first city of Asia. And one of the main attractions there within Smyrna was the fact that it had the largest marketplace in all of the ancient world. And additionally, adding on to that, it was known as the most beautiful city in all of Asia Minor. And it was beautiful because of its landscape and because of its architecture. Being on the sea, it was a seaside city. But moving from the sea inland, you would go across beautiful rolling hills. Makes me think of the hills of East Tennessee and how that landscape plays out. And what it did is it led up to a single highest point, which was called the Pagos. And upon the top of Pagos was beautiful architecture, beautiful buildings that was nicknamed at that time the Crown of Cybele. Cybele was a goddess within Roman culture. And and one poet looking at the city and just observing it from afar, this is what he said. He said that the statue, that Smyrna stood as a statue of the goddess Cybele, that her feet are on the sea and then her head is crowned with the beautiful buildings that set on top of the Pagos. Within Smyrna as well was a 2,000 person spectator theater. They had wide roads that were also paved. That must have been nice during the first century. And then also they had their own Olympic-style games. Smyrna was no bump in the road. Smyrna was a strong, thriving city, one of the most important cities in all of Asia Minor. And within any sort of strong city within Asia Minor, you would expect to see temples, and that's exactly what was found within Smyrna as well. Temples to different deities such as Zeus, Apollo, Aphrodite, Asclepius, and Cybele, as I already mentioned. They also had temples dedicated to Caesar worship, emperor worship, and they even had a temple dedicated to the great poet Homer. Many believe that he was born in Smyrna and spent much time in that city. And Smyrna was also a hotspot for academia, science, and medicine. There were schools for science and medicine within this city, a large public library, a museum. Even the name itself, Smyrna, has a medicinal background. Smyrna comes from the word myrrh. That might sound familiar to you. It's one of the gifts that was given to Jesus upon His birth. But myrrh was a substance, a resin, that was used to help the embalming of bodies and also help to slow down fish from beginning to stink and begin to putrefy. So this city was very, very important for a number of different ways, not just religiously, but also from an academic standpoint. And, oh, by the way, it also was a very old city. Many believe that it was established 1,000 years before Christ. And if you look on a map today where you saw Smyrna in the first century, continues to be where Smyrna is today. The city is actually still around. In present-day Turkey, though, it goes by a new name, that name being Izmir. Izmir, Turkey, is a city that contains about 200,000 people. And part of those 2,000 people is actually a small population of Bible-professing and Bible-believing Christians, which is interesting considering the fact that Turkey is under the rule of Islam. So for there to be Christians within that city is something especially extraordinary. Now, let's see what Jesus had to say to this church, the first century church that was in Smyrna at the end of the first century. What did He have to say to this church? And what does that mean to us as well? Let's begin in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 8. Revelation 2 and verse 8. Write to the angel of the church in Smyrna. Thus says the first and the last, the one who was dead and came to life. I know your affliction and poverty, but you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews but are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. Look, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison to test you, and you will experience affliction for 10 days. Be faithful, and I will give you the crown of life. Let anyone who has ears to hear, listen to what this to the churches. The one who conquers will never be harmed by the second death. Just a few short verses here within this message to this specific church. But notice to begin with, notice how Jesus begins this message. He begins it by establishing Himself, I would suggest to you, as being both divine and also authoritative. That Jesus begins this message by establishing to those who are reading it, I am someone who is in need of you listening to. You need to listen to me. You need to listen to these words. For Jesus to say, I am the first and the last, the one who was dead and came to life. First of all, that should sound familiar to us because we read that at the very onset of this lesson. It's not the first time that Jesus has used this type of language. Back in chapter 1. Back in chapter 1 and verses 17 and 18. Notice that John's response as he falls to the ground, that Jesus touches him with his right hand. And he says, don't be afraid, I am what? The first and the last. The exact same thing he says in chapter 2 and verse 8. He says, and the living one, I was dead, but look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. You know, what is Jesus implying to us by making these statements, not just once, but twice? I would suggest to you, first of all, that as Jesus is making this statement, He is trying to show us His divine and eternal nature. To refer to Himself as the first and the last is to put Himself on level ground with God. God Himself, God the Father, is divine, is eternal, and is authoritative. And that this type of phraseology that is used here, the first and the last, is actually found twice within Isaiah. Isaiah 44 and verse 6. Isaiah 44 and verse 6 and also Isaiah 48 and verse 12. In both of these instances, the same language is used, God referring to Himself as the first and the last. In Isaiah 44's reference, that comes in the context of God saying, I am the first and the last. I am the only God. There are no other gods before me. And then within Isaiah 48, the context there is God saying that He has power to make whatever He wants to happen, happen. For Jesus to say, I am the first and the last, He is to say, I am divine, I have authority, you need to listen to these words I am telling you. And then later on in Revelation 22 and verse 13, He refers to Himself as the Alpha and the Omega. The exact same terminology, just said in a different way. But further, as Jesus states that He is the one that was dead and came back to life, He is showing the degree to which He has power. The degree to which He can do incredible things in this life. That He has control not only over life, but He has control over death. That Jesus allowed Himself to come to earth in human flesh. That He allowed Himself to be put to death. But that His body did not decay in the grave. His body did not remain in the grave as David predicted. But that He was raised. Now this wasn't the first time that anybody had seen Jesus have power over death. He raised multiple people during His ministry. But for Jesus Himself to be the one that dies, and then to be the one that was raised, was taking things again just to another level. He says in Revelation 1 and verse 18, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Man, must that not have sounded nice to a church that was being persecuted? These words were nothing but encouragement to know that the One who is God, the One who died but now lives and will live forever and ever, to have this One write to us. It would be like if we received in the mailbox a letter that was signed by Jesus, and it actually was from Jesus. Just imagine how incredible that would be. Yeah, that's exactly what these brethren had received. They had received words from Jesus Himself. Words that would encourage them. Words that would hopefully sustain them in the difficulties that they were facing. And Jesus makes that point within this text. He wants them to be aware, in verse number 9, that I know of your sufferings, I know of your afflictions, I know of your poverty. How encouraging just right off the bat to know that God knows what I'm going through. That He knows that I'm struggling. That He is not unaware of the difficulties I am facing. As we noted earlier, Smyrna was a city overflowing with emperor worship. not just emperor worship, but pagan worship. We'll get to that in just a second. And being a place that was overrun with this type of worship would have been very difficult, would have made it very difficult for a Christian to live in such a place, especially whenever it came to the demands that were under emperor worship. Especially during the reign of Domitian, annual sacrifices were required. Each citizen, annual sacrifices not to God, but to the emperor. They were required of each citizen, and failure to do so was seen as a capital offense. If you had not offered your sacrifice, you were then worthy to die. And the same would be true, not just for offering a sacrifice, but if a Roman soldier stopped you and said and told you, proclaim Caesar as Lord. If they said that, and you said, no, I refuse to do that, then you as well could die right then on the spot. And this refusal to do such a thing, for us, we understand why. There is but one Lord, that is Jesus Christ. There is but one God, the God of heaven. For them to not proclaim Caesar as Lord was to simply not go against their convictions. But to those who lived within Smyrna, they saw that as nothing but rebellion. These people are just causing trouble. These people just don't want to culture. They don't want to fit in with the rest of the city. And yet we even know that's not the case. That's not the case because Jesus told His people, be a peaceful people. Be a people who are compliant citizens. And we do that as Christians. We follow the laws of the land. We try to live quiet and peaceful lives. But if it ever comes to the point where we would be going against our convictions, the convictions that are found within our faith, those are no-goes. And that was especially true during the time of the first century for these Christians that were living in Smyrna. That's just emperor worship, though. Think about the pagan worship that took place within this city. What really made this difficult was the fact that the paganism that was within Smyrna, it was closely tied in with the culture. It was closely tied in with just society and how it was run. Therefore, if you did not participate in pagan worship, if you weren't worshiping Zeus, if you weren't worshiping Aphrodite, if you weren't worshiping these other gods, then you were just kind of out of the loop. You were seen as being outside society. You were seen as being out of touch from culture. And besides that, for these people in Smyrna who had idols all around, for these people who called themselves religious people, and yet they did not have a tangible idol that they could touch, that they can kneel down before, well, the pagans just saw Christians as being kind of confused atheists. You say that you worship a God, yet you don't even know what He looks like. They say, here, look, I have a Zeus right here. What do you have? Well, the Christian would show them nothing. And the pagan would say, see, you're nothing but an atheist. You don't believe in a God. Like I do. Like we do within this culture. And all of this by itself would be difficult to deal with. It would be difficult for the Christians within Smyrna to live within this culture, to live within this society, to live always knowing that their life could be taken if they did not submit to the emperor as Lord, if they did not submit to Caesar as Lord. And yet, what added further difficulty to their lives is what Jesus says within this text. Not just that I know your affliction, but also know your poverty. I know your poverty. The specific word that is translated poor within this text, the word petaheia, it literally means nothing, having nothing. It wasn't just that these people were on the lower portions of the socioeconomic scale within Smyrna, but they were the bottom. They were the dirt poor people. MacArthur makes a really good point in his book. He said that they not only lacked basic resources, but they also lacked the means to improve their situation. There was no moving within the socioeconomic scale for Christians. They had nothing, and they had no ability to gain anything. And yet, this encourages these disciples by saying, I know your affliction and I know your poverty, but you are rich. You are rich. How? How was it that these disciples were rich? Well, Jesus knew the spiritual treasures that they had built up in heaven. Jesus knew of their faithfulness. He knew of their striving for holiness. He knew of their trust. He knew of the perseverance that they had within them. And for that, Jesus says, you are rich. And you know what that stands in stark contrast of? What was said to the Laodiceans? In Revelation 3 and verse 17, for you say, Jesus says to Laodiceans, you say, I'm rich and I have become wealthy and need nothing, but you don't realize that you are wretched and pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. You have brethren in Smyrna who were literally poor, blind, naked, and without nothing. Yeah, Jesus says they're rich. And you in Laodicea, you think that you are great, but you're nothing. Why? Because you stand before me without faith. And we'll talk about Laodicea here within the next few weeks. But Jesus just wants to encourage these brethren. I know your poverty. I know that you have nothing and that you're never going to have anything. But know that before me, you are rich. And Jesus also wants to let them know that He knows who is one of the great sources of their trouble, that it is the fake Jews. They are identified within this message as being those who are responsible for the troubles they were facing. These brethren in Smyrna, they were just being pounded from all sides. You have the emperor worship going on one end, you have the pagan worship going on at another end, and then to box it in, you have the persecution from Jews. Jews who are described within this text as being the synagogue of Satan. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews but are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. How is it that Jesus says that they are Jews, but that they say they're Jews but are not? Does that mean that they say they are of the lineage of Abraham and yet they're actually not of the lineage of Abraham? Well, that's probably not true from a physical standpoint. They might truly be of the lineage of Abraham. I believe what Jesus is referring to here, though, is what we find in Romans 2 and verses 28 and 29. Romans chapter 2 and verses 28 and 29. For a person is not a Jew who is a Jew outwardly. And true circumcision is not something visible in the flesh. On the contrary, a person is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is of the heart by the Spirit, not the letter. That person phrases not from people, but from God. These Jews in Smyrna, they had given up their Jewish nature whenever they refused to acknowledge Jesus as Christ. Whenever they refused to acknowledge that God was working through Jesus to bring about the third promise to Abraham, that through your lineage, all nations of the earth will be blessed. When they refused to acknowledge Jesus, they gave up their right to call themselves a true Jew. And in reality, those who were in Smyrna, those who might have been as far as you possibly could be away from being a literal blood lineage Jew, Jesus says they are more Jewish than you are. And how sad it was that some of the greatest problems that were caused to the Christians in Smyrna, that those problems were caused by people who should have known better. Caused by people who practiced Judaism from which Christianity came forth. How sad that to be the case. And yet really that's nothing new at all. That was happening even during Jesus' day. Who were some of His greatest opponents? Was it not the Jewish leadership? Who were constantly causing the greatest problems for the Apostle Paul and other disciples in the first century? Was it not the Jews that Paul would go from city to city and he would go to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and he would begin to proclaim Jesus as the Christ? Who would stand up and shout and tell him to be quiet? Was it not the Jews? What happened in Smyrna was not particular to Smyrna, but that didn't lessen the impact of the persecution at all. And that's why Jesus refers to these people as the synagogue of Satan. He's saying, you're no different than the emperor worshipers. You're no different than the pagans. You're no different at all. They persecute my people. You persecute my people. Jesus says, please tell me what is the difference. You think that you are devoting yourselves to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but you cannot be further from the truth. They had no part of being a part of the people of God because they were the very ones who had rejected Christ and were persecuting His followers. And you would hope that Jesus, maybe at this point, as He's talked about their afflictions and their poverty, as He's identified some of their persecution, you would hope at this point Jesus is going to say, "Hey guys, it's okay, brighter days are ahead." Unfortunately, that's not the case at all. Though there is no rebuke found within this message, no criticism, there is a very strong warning. And it's a warning concerning impending sufferings. Things aren't enough as they were, but Jesus uses this portion of this message to not only encourage these disciples, but to warn them. To warn them that soon more trouble would be upon them. Don't be afraid, Revelation 2:10, of what you're about to suffer. Look, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison to test you, and you will experience affliction for 10 days. Be faithful to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. You know, there's nothing recorded that we can really nail down specifically that identifies exactly what Jesus is speaking to here. It's not like it is within Matthew and the other Gospels where Jesus predicts the following Jerusalem, but we could say that's exactly what Jesus was talking about. We don't have anything we can really point to specifically for this. I mean, if Jesus really was being very literal and saying that you're about to be thrown in prison, you're about to be there for 10 days, then we can't point to anything concerning that. Now, some would say that Jesus is being figurative here. I don't really know if I buy that or not. But whatever it might be, whether He's being figurative, whether He's being literal, we simply don't know what this is specifically referring to. However, history does tell us the persecution did happen. And the persecution was very strong within the city of Smyrna. And that shouldn't surprise us, considering what we've already talked about. The fact of the way the culture was, the society was, and how pagan worship and emperor worship were so intertwined there within it, and the problems that they suffered from their Jewish brethren. Yet there is one story that is recorded in history. Some writings from before the year 325 that records some things that happened within the early church and early church leaders. And there's one particular man who was from Smyrna. His name was Polycarp. He's a very famous martyr for the Christian faith and part of the earliest Christians. And this man is known in history as being a disciple of John. That in his earliest years he followed John and maybe he was even a part of the ministry that John had throughout the world at that time. But later on, history also tells us that he was one of the pastors, one of the shepherds within the church here in Smyrna. And he is somebody that history also tells us had an ironclad resolve even in the face of impending death. I'd like to share with you an excerpt from MacArthur's book here on Polycarp just to illustrate exactly the kind of thing that Christians in Smyrna were going through that history tells us. The story of Polycarp's martyrdom illustrates how the entire city was aligned against the church and eager to usher in its demise. History tells us Polycarp died during a festival of public games. Under Rome, that meant public executions. The Jews and the pagans banded together and clamored for his head. Polycarp had no selfish interest in running for his life. He had a dream in which he saw the pillow under his head burning, and he was convinced that this was a sign that he would be alive. But in deference to the church, he did leave the city to stay with friends in the countryside. His pursuers were enraged when they couldn't find him, so they seized two children and tortured the children until one of them gave up his location. Tradition tells us that even the soldiers who arrested him and returned him to the city did not want to see him die. They pleaded with him to curse God and say Caesar is Lord, or offer a simple sacrifice to the emperor to save his own life. But we're told the faithful pastor responded, 86 years have I served him, and he never did me any injury. How then can I blaspheme my King and my Savior?" When news of his capture spread throughout the city, the excitement was so great that crowds gathered whatever scraps of wood they could find in shops and baths to build the bonfire. The Jews were so eager to see him killed that they brought more wood than anyone else, actually violating the Sabbath in the process. But Polycarp was unmoved by the threat of death. He challenged his persecutors. "You threaten me with fire, which burns for an hour, and after a little is extinguished. But you are ignorant of the fire of the coming judgment and of eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly. But why tarry you? Bring forth what you will." Tradition tells us that his executioners did not nail him to the stake as was customary. Before they could, Polycarp told them, "Leave me as I am. For he that gives me strength to endure the fire will also enable me, without your securing me by nails, to remain without moving in the pile." Some accounts include the detail that he seemed so tranquil amid the flames that someone reached in with a sword to hasten his death. MacArthur goes on to say, "That's what life was like for the church in Smyrna. Every believer in the church had to live daily in the psalmist's bold proclamation, Psalm 56 and verse 11, in God I put my trust. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me?" We might often think that the things we read in Scripture, or we might often read what we read in Scripture and really not make connection with the fact that it really happened. Not to say that we don't believe it really happened, but we don't read it from a extra-biblical perspective that really hits home with us. And yet when Jesus said sufferings were coming, He meant sufferings were coming. And what Polycarp went through was probably not what Jesus was specifically referring to. The reality is that sufferings did come upon the church in Smyrna. And that's why Jesus, in preparing them to endure these sufferings, closes this message by giving the ultimate encouragement of eternal life to those who would remain faithful and who would persevere through the difficulties. "Be faithful to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. Let anyone who has ears to hear listen to what the Spirit says to the churches, and the one who conquers will never be harmed by the second death." The persecutions, they were firmly on the doorstep of the believers in Smyrna. And yet they knew they could overcome whatever was thrown at them because they served the God who is the first and the last. Those introductory words, the very first words that Jesus says, "I am the first and last, the one who was dead but is now alive," those tie in exactly with what we read at the end. Just as Jesus defeated death, He's telling His disciples here, "You will as well." Though not the first death. That death we will suffer. That's what Hebrews 9 and verse 27 says. Is appointed once for men to die and then the judgment. For some of these individuals, their death was going to be a result of their faith. They were going to be stopped on the road. A soldier would say, "Tell me that Caesar is Lord." They would refuse, and their body would hit the ground. Be faithful to the point of death. Too long I said, that just means be faithful all your life. Brethren, that's not what that means. It means be faithful even if it means your death is brought on because of your faith. And Jesus says, "I will give you a crown of life." What is that crown of life to? It's the exact same crown that Paul said he was going to receive in 2 Timothy 4. That same crown that he was going to receive because he had run his race well, these brethren were going to receive because of their faithfulness and perseverance. And some believe that in Jesus saying, I will give you the crown of life, that's a direct shot at the pagans within Smyrna. Remember, the pagos and the great buildings on the top were referred to as the crown. Jesus said, I'm going to give you the real crown. And it's the crown of life. Then, as I mentioned, they would suffer death. They would suffer death, but just as Jesus Himself defeated death, and just as He held the keys to death in Hades, He will one day bring forth the dead. All of those who die will raise in the last day. And there's going to be a separating of the faithful and the unfaithful. And we read about what that separation is going to look like at the end of Revelation, specifically for the faithful in Revelation 21 in verses 3 and 4. That those who are faithful, they are going to be able to go in the place where God's dwelling is with humanity, and He will live with them. They will be His peoples, and God Himself will be with them and will be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Grief, crying, and pain will be no more because the previous things have passed away. Jesus says, be faithful until the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. And you will not suffer the second death. That those who are faithful and persevere, they will be raised from the dead and they will live forevermore. Because they live with God. But for those who had no faith, those who did not persevere to the end, this is what Jesus says in Revelation 20, beginning in verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne, and one seated on it. Earth and heaven fled from His presence, and no place was found for them. I also saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works by what was written in the books. Then the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and the death and Hades gave up their dead that were in them. Each one was judged according to their works. Death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone whose name was not found in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. That those who are not found in the book of life, they will experience the second death away from the presence of God for all eternity. Could not be a worse place to be. No matter what we suffer in this life, no matter what our Smyrna brethren suffered in this life, none of it compares to being away from God forever. And that is the encouragement that is given by Jesus to these brethren. Be faithful. Continue to confess Jesus. Follow Him in everything that you do while you're on this earth. And while we might find it heartbreaking and even mind-blowing to think that brethren could experience what many believe Polycarp experienced, we are given these things so that we might learn, so that we might be encouraged, so that we might persevere. Brethren, if nothing else, we ought to leave these considerations being so thankful. So, so thankful. To not live in a place like Smyrna. Not because these places don't exist anymore. Brethren, they do. Smyrna is alive and well today in many places in this world. And we should be thankful to God that He gives us the ability to serve Him in such peace as we do. But we must also be resolved because of this peace to be prepared, because that could change. As unthinkable as that might be to us, that could always change. And may we be a people who are even ready to be faithful until the point of death. As Jesus says, may we be a people who hear. And may we not just hear, but may we conquer. May we conquer this world. May we conquer the evil one. May we conquer his minions. So that we too might not experience a second death, but experience life eternal with our Lord forevermore.